government does is still their town. But there's a little bit of part-time stuff, of course. But for lunch, so the thing is that today is actually a national holiday in the province. And so university cafeterias are closed. So so the lunch, and maybe this will be anyway the economical place for lunch, is to go down on Côte de Neige, so follow the problem and all that. There's enough local. I mean, you can be limited, and there are plenty of places there, and many of them should be open. I hope there's a list in your package. Right, and for all other practical questions, I'll ask me or Martina, but without any today, so our first lecturer, we are very happy, George Barnatan, and he's going to give a quick introduction to polynomial homology.
So, thank you for inviting me, thank you for coming. My talk will follow a handout, a condensed form of is on the board right now. If you don't have a copy should have come with registration. If you don't have a copy, then I have a few more here, and there are a few more in the back by the door on the desk over there. So please pick up a copy. Okay, so I assume everybody has a copy. Let me say that I no longer do link homologies. I played some role in the beginning of the subject, but it's not what I do now. I'm sort of a relic from old times, and I'm totally not up to date. People, there are definitely lots of people here who know the subject as it is now way better than me. So let me hope that that's why I was invited, okay? So as to start the conference at a relatively sort of slow pace, low level, old times way. And that's all I can do, so that's what you will get, okay? Hopefully the speakers who will follow me later will be saying more modern and more fast-paced, interesting, exciting stuff. Okay? But anyway, again, if we're talking about history, then why bother? Why is this subject so exciting? So from my perspective as a non-theorist, or in fact equally well, from the perspective of people coming from representation theory, there used to be a game board, and we used to understand it pretty well. I mean, it was still fun to play on it, but we used to feel that we understand it reasonably well. You know, you go clockwise, you try to avoid a certain square, I don't know, you try to avoid the J square, you kind of, well, there are still some question marks, but we used to feel that we know the game board pretty well. Then, around 1999, came Hovanov and found that one of the squares in our game board, the J square, the Jones polynomial square, actually had an extra dimension. So instead of just being a polynomial, meaning a set of numbers, the coefficients of that polynomial, it was a homology theory. Okay, whose Euler characteristic was this set of numbers. So it somehow had an extra dimension. And immediately, that led to a huge excitement because everybody started wondering, maybe the rest of the game board has an extra dimension too. Okay? And that was the great excitement back then. And I think by now, it is clear that much of the rest of the game board also has this extra dimension, and many people here will be talking about it later on, and hopefully I will learn something. But let me also say why I don't do it anymore. And one reason why I'm no longer in the business is because I realize that I actually don't understand the original game board at all. Okay? And again, it's a, maybe I should say that that's a personal statement. There may be other people in the room who do understand the original game board completely and fully, but I don't. So I want to study the original back game board a little bit further. So just as an example, here's a story or a theorem. Okay? So the theorem says that to every finite dimensional metrized Lie algebra, so Lie algebra with a invariant non-degenerate inner product, in every collection R1 up to Rn of representations of that Lie algebra, there is an invariant of n component links which takes values in Laurent polynomials in a variable Q. Okay, so somehow this is the in some sense the foundation of the game board, because it says that there is some pairing between Lie theory and knot theory, and the J square of the game board is that pairing when evaluated on the simplest Lie algebra, SL2, where you take all the representations to be the two-dimensional representations, and Chovanov homology was the subject of bringing that particular box in that subject one dimension up. Yet, do I really understand this theorem? So, at least I don't. Could I convince you in 1 hour that that theorem is true? The answer is no. I mean, maybe I could convince you that to every Lie algebra and that to every Lie algebra in a set of representations, there is an invariant of knots and links corresponding to it. Okay. But I wouldn't be able to tell you why it's a polynomial. Okay? Why the invariant takes values in that place. I could tell you why it's a power series. But why is this power series a polynomial? The answer is, and this is absolutely essential, as you will see in a minute, for the purpose of categorification. The answer is, well, I wouldn't say that I don't know, but it definitely doesn't fit in an hour. In fact, I doubt it fits in a one-semester course if you don't skip any details, okay? It requires much background, or way too much background, from representation theory. And again, I don't know how to say it without the background, and I wouldn't expect it to require so much of that background. So you see, the statement of the theorem is about metrized Lie algebras. The proof of the theorem, in as much as I know it, uses the classification of Lie algebras. So you talk about simple Lie algebras, you talk about semi-simple Lie algebras, you look at Cartan subgroups, you look at root systems. It all looks too complicated for what the statement is saying. And in fact, I don't even know if the statement is true, because the way it is stated for semi-simple Lie algebras. The way it is stated, it was stated for metrized Lie algebras, but the standard constructions involve semi-simple Lie algebras. So the statement is slightly more general than the thing that is normally proven. So I still don't understand the original game board, and therefore, I'm back to thinking about it. This said, that's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm only going to talk about the one box that I do understand, and this is the Jones polynomial and Chovanov homology. So, okay, let me start. Oh, sorry, again, it being the opening talk, I'll start with some philosophy. And again, I hope people, the experts, will agree with me about the philosophy. It might even be that my philosophy is wrong. Okay? So, you know, this is the baby version. This is me, sort of, or it's not. It's a picture of a person from a movie. But But you should be thinking of it as me, speaking about my baby understanding of what categorification is. So what's categorification? So in some sense, it's moving mathematics from adult to baby. Okay? So sort of one complicated thing that we learn when we are about 3 or maybe 5 or something like that is to identify or is the abstract notion of the number 3. What is the number 3? The number 3 is the equivalence class of all sets that have 3 elements. Okay, equivalence under bijection, I suppose. So the number 3 could represent either a set with a red cow, a green cow, or a blue cow, or a red pig and a green pig, or and a blue pig, or any of many other things. Categorification, in some sense, is concretization. It's to say which 3 it is. So if before categorification the answer is 3, you compute something and the answer is 3, after categorification the answer should be which 3 it is. Okay? Except this is naive and in reality it's a bit more complicated. So let me go through the sequence of thought that leads to Euler characteristics of complexes. Okay? So first of all, what's categorification of the natural numbers? So as I said, it's finite sets, and then equalities become bijections, and if you want inequalities, it will be injections and surjections. And maybe I'll give you an example. So there is a standard formula in combinatorics saying that 2n choose n is the sum of n choose k squared. Okay? This identity categorified or concretized becomes this following statement. If you take a finite set X and cross it with a set with 2 elements, so now you have a set with 2n elements, right? If X had n elements and X cross 1, 2 has 2n elements. And you look at, so let's declare that set, that the symbol binomial coefficients of a set and a number will mean the collection of all subsets of the set of the top that have as many elements as are written here. Okay? So the thing on the left here is the set of all subsets of a specific set with 2n elements which have precisely n elements. And if you wanted to be even more concrete, I would say it's the set of all subsets of a set with 2n elements, or of the set X cross 1, 2, which can be put in a bijection with the set X. Okay, so this is a concretization of the left-hand side. A concretization of the right-hand side would be the union over all k of the set of subsets of size k of x cross the set of subsets of size k of x. Okay? Now, a categorified proof of this statement would be to find the bijection between the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So again, to find the bijection between the set of all subsets of size n of a set with 2n elements and the set of all pairs of 2 subsets of X which have the same size. So it's of course an easy exercise. I'm sure many of you have done it. If you have not done it, take your time and do it now or do it afterwards, but I only meant it to illustrate what very, very naive categorification would be. Comments, by the way? Any? Okay. Anyway, here's slightly less naive categorification, or in fact, let me move on, and how would I categorify the integers, meaning the natural numbers, but also including the negative numbers? So you see, again, when you're in grade 1, you're told that negative numbers are about stuff that you owe, rather than stuff that you have. Okay? So, how would you categorify the negative numbers? We'd be talking about pairs of sets. A set x0 and a set x1, where the set x0 stands for the things that you have, and the set x1 stands for the things that you owe. Okay? Slightly more sophisticated. It turns out that, you know, that's a lovely notion, but you can't do much with it. So here's a slightly more sophisticated version with which you can do a little bit more. So it will be a pair of sets of have and owe, except I'd be thinking of it completely concretely. So this is a set of three cows that I think I have. And this is a set of five death certificates that my neighbor is holding, and each one is saying that I owe him a cow. Okay? And in between there will be a partial bijection, which will say that this particular death certificate corresponds to this particular cow. So some of the death certificates will actually say which cow it is that they refer to. Okay? So that's again a way of describing the natural numbers. The natural number described over, sorry, the integers. The integer described over here is, well, these two debts are cancelled, one cow I have three, but my neighbor has three debt certificates, so overall I would call it that I have negative two cows. Okay? But then there is an even more sophisticated version of the same. So, you know, I could have a number of cows. My neighbor could have a number of death certificates, some of which could be paired with some of my cows. But I could also have a number of court orders that invalidate the death certificates that my neighbor thinks he has. Okay? And in fact, some of these court orders might be paired with some of the death certificates. But these death certificates better not be paired with cows, because that would be an invalid situation. Okay? So, basically, an integer would be a sequence of things with partial bijections between them, with pairings of their elements that are somehow compatible, that do not intersect. Okay? Where the first set would represent things that I have, the second set would represent things that I owe, the third set would represent things that I don't really owe, and so on. Okay? Now, I would have to talk about what an equality means. Okay? So, if these are the integers, what does it mean for two integers to be equal? But I think I'd rather postpone it and talk about it when I talk about the even more real notion of categorification that we will be talking about. So, okay, again, in reality, even this is too much to hope for. So, you get an integer, it's a bit too much to expect to get a sequence of things like that as its concretization. In reality, often all that we can do is to categorify in the category of vector spaces. So the number 3 becomes a vector space whose dimension is 3. Okay? So, you know, if you compare it with the previous notion, in the previous case it would be, well, I could also make a vector space with dimension 3. It would be the vector space whose basis is the set of cows that I have. Okay? So, but in a weaker categorification, I would simply not be given the basis, I would only be given the vector space. So it's some concretization, but less complete one. Okay? And in fact, sort of the thing explained over here, so a categorification of the integers, would be a sequence of vector spaces, well, VR minus 1, and a map into VR, and a map into VR plus 1, and so on.
So that if you do the map, let's call the map D, so if you follow the map twice, you get zero, which is the parallel of the condition that these blue lines here never, or that, that these, well, that these pairings are disjoint, okay? And then the integer represented by such a sequence, by the way, such a sequence, as I hope you all know, is called a complex. So the integer represented by such a complex will be, well, just like here, it will be the alternating sum of the dimensions of the vector spaces, okay, which is called the Euler characteristic of the complex. And alternatively, it's the alternating sum of the dimensions of the homologies of the complex. What are the homologies of the complex? The homologies are the things, well, essentially are the leftovers in each set after you cancel all the things that are paired with sets from before or sets after. Okay? So so that's the Euler characteristic. And now I can also say what is an equality. So the thing equality will correspond to complexes that are homotopy equivalent. And again, I've gone way up in sophistication, but, well, you know, if you want to categorify anything real, it's a little more than just the naive notion. Yes?
And over what field are these vector spaces?
Oh, well, I'm sufficiently loose that it doesn't matter. I guess I will work over Q today, but you could work over any field, okay? And in fact, you could be even more loose and work over the integers, and then you'll have to be talking about ranks rather than... But, okay?
Okay.
So the next thing, before I really start with the Jones polynomial, is to tell you how you categorify Laurent polynomials. So suppose f is a Laurent polynomial, then if all the coefficients are positive, then I could replace it by, well, instead of a vector space, it would be a graded vector space. So, namely, what you see, a Laurent polynomial is a sequence of integers, one for each degree. If I want to categorify it, I'll simply take a sequence of vector spaces, one for each degree. But a sequence of vector spaces, V sub j, one for each degree, is also commonly known as a graded vector space. Namely, you take the direct sum of all of these vector spaces, Vj, call it capital V, and it's a vector space which is presented as a sum, and the direct summons are called parts of various degrees. Okay? So the condition will be that the q dimension of V, namely the generating functions of the dimensions, namely the sum of q to the j times the dimension of Vj, will be f. So a categorified Laurent polynomial would be a graded vector space whose qdim is that Laurent polynomial. But of course, this only categorifies Laurent polynomials with positive coefficients. If I wanted to categorify arbitrary Laurent polynomials and take my q from what I did before, then it will be a sequence of such graded vector spaces with maps in between them, namely it would be a graded complex, so that the square of the map is zero, the degree of the map is zero, the degree of the differential is zero, which just means that it maps the degree, so to say that the degree of D is zero means that you map the degree D piece of this vector space to the degree D piece of that vector space, which amounts to saying that this isn't really a sequence of that really this sequence of vector spaces or this complex decomposes into a direct sum of several complexes, one for each degree.
Okay. And then with the property that the polynomial F that I started from is the graded Euler characteristic of the complex, which means the alternating sum of the graded dimensions of the vector spaces, which equivalently is the alternating sum of the graded dimensions of the homologies. And then what is equality? So what is equality of two polynomials? It becomes a homotopy equivalence, a homotopy between two complexes.
Okay, so two notes.
One note, given a graded vector space, V, there is an operation, let me call it shifting the degree up by L, and denoted V bracket L, and it's defined as follows. So you just shift the degree of anything in V up by L units, which amounts to saying that if you look at V shifted up L in degree J, then that's the original V in degree J minus L. Okay? Because, well, we've shifted up the degree everything by L, so if you look in degree J, then you have to look at the original thing in degree L less. Okay? And then it's easy to check that the Q dimension of V shifted L times is Q to the L times the Q dimension of V. And I guess the other note that I would like to make before continuing, well, I forgot to put it on the handout, so let me see if I am able to write on the screen. So the other note is that if V and W are graded, sorry, my handwriting is so horrible. So is the tensor product of V and W. And you simply declare that the tensor product of V and W in degree K is the direct sum of all ways of reaching to degree K by taking some degree I from the V side and some degree J from the W side. So it will be the direct sum over all I plus J equal K of VI tensor VJ. Sorry, WJ. Tensor WJ. Okay? And then with this definition, so this makes the this defines a tensor product on graded vector spaces, and with this definition, one can check that the quantum dimension, or sorry, the Q dimension of V tensor W is equal to the Q dimension of V times the Q dimension of W. And in this is, and indeed, this is because the formula written here for the definition of the tensor product is very similar to the definition of a product of polynomials. So if you have a polynomial f, which is sum ai q to the I, and a polynomial g, which is sum bj q to the j, then f times g at degree k is equal to, so in other words, F times G is equal to the sum over K of Q to the K times the degree K piece, where the degree K piece is a precise analog of the formula written over there. So it's the sum as I plus J is equal to K of AI BJ. Okay. And then it went too technical. But let me go on to the thing that I actually want to categorify. So here is the Jones polynomial in two lines, as described by Lou Kaufman. I just saw him come in. Lou, can you show yourself back there? As described by Lou Kaufman how many years ago? 25 years ago? Some large number of years ago. Okay. So, okay. Here's the complete definition in two lines. Okay? So, it's a polynomial which is associated to knots or links, and it takes values in Laurent polynomials in a variable q. And there are other ways and other normalization, but my way and my normalization is as follows. Wherever you see an overcrossing in your knot or link, well, what's an overcrossing? It's a plus crossing. You distinguish plus from minus by some rule that has to do with your right hand. I don't know, you put your hand on the upper strand with the thumb pointing in the direction of the flow, and then you hope that the fingers, you know, the fingers either point with the flow of the other strand or against the flow of the other strand. Anyway, that defines a sign for each crossing, and the Jones polynomial is defined by mapping the plus sign crossings to q times the zero cross smoothing minus q squared times a one smoothing. Now, what are zero smoothing and one smoothings? So again, there is some rule that has to do with going into the intersection from the under strand and then either turning to the left or turning to the right, and that will define either the zero smoothing or the one smoothing, and I can't remember which is which, and I don't think it really matters. It's just sufficient for you to know that it can be defined. Okay, it's an easy thing. And in fact, the picture is defined. Okay? So J maps an overcrossing to Q times a zero smoothing minus Q squared times a one smoothing, and an undercrossing to negative Q to the minus 2 times a zero smoothing plus Q to the minus 1 times a one smoothing. When you do it to all crossings in your diagram, in your knot diagram, you're left with a picture that has no crossings. So it's just a picture that has a bunch of circles in the plane, and then you apply the second rule, and the second rule is that if you have k circles in the plane, you map them to q plus q inverse to the power k. If that wasn't concrete enough, let me do an example. So let's start from the trefoil knot. The trefoil knot has three crossings called 1, 2, and 3. Well, I just decided to label them 1, 2, and 3. Each of the three crossings should be replaced by a zero smoothing or a one smoothing. So the overall number of choices to make is 2 cubed, which is 8. But in anticipation of what's to follow, I will arrange these 8 choices along the vertices of a three-dimensional cube. The three-dimensional cube whose coordinates are 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on up to 1, 1, 1. Here is this cube drawn here. Furthermore, I project the cube so that the points whose sum of coordinates is 0 are in a first column. The points, the vertices of the cube whose sum of coordinates is 1 are in a second column, in column number 1, this should be column number 0. The points whose sum of coordinates is 2 is in column 2, and the points, the vertices whose sum of coordinates is 3 is in column 3. So I hope you can see the cube here. The boxes are the vertices, and the arrows here are the edges. Okay? Is the cube visible? Okay. Now, each box of the cube corresponds to a smoothing of the original knot projection. So, for example, the box right here is the box, is the vertex 0, 1, 0. It will correspond to taking the 0 smoothing of the first vertex, the 1 smoothing of the, second crossing, the 0 smoothing of the third crossing, and hopefully it's this picture. Hopefully what you get is the thing written here. The thing written here comes with a coefficient. The coefficient is, well, you see, the coefficients before were a q for each zero smoothing and a q squared for each one smoothing. So I have two zero smoothings and one two smoothing, and one one smoothing. So overall, I get q to the fourth. Right? Q times q times q squared. So I get the coefficient of q to the fourth. And then when I look at the smoothing itself, I find that it has one connected component. So I get q plus q inverse. Likewise, in this box, I will be getting q to the fifth as the coefficient. But since I get two smoothings here, sorry, two components here, the contribution from the second step will be q plus q inverse squared. I hope you can read it either on the screen or at least on the handout. Okay? Can you, by the way? Okay. You see, maybe it's because I'm near the screen, but near the screen it looks completely out of focus. Probably from where you are it actually looks better. Anyway, then I have to sum the content of these boxes, except I neglected to take care of the minus signs, so really I have to sum the content of these boxes so that the column 0 comes with a plus sign, column 1 comes with a minus sign, column 3 with column 2 with plus, and column 3 with minus. So what I do is I sum along the columns and bring it up to the top. At the top I get, for the zeroth column, I get q cubed times q plus q inverse squared. For column 1 I'll get that. For column 2 I'll get that. For column 3 I'll get that. And when I take the alternating sum of these column sums, I will get the quantity written way up there and slightly hidden by my yellow stuff, which is q plus q cubed plus q to the fifth minus q to the ninth, which is the Jones polynomial of the trefoil knot. Okay? So is the definition of the Jones polynomial clear? Now, of course, the next thing to do is to prove that the Jones polynomial is actually an invariant of knots. Well, to show that it's an invariant of knots, you need to show that it is an invariant under the three Rademeister groups. And I will do only Rademeister 2, which for some reason turns out to be the most interesting for the Jones polynomial. So I need to show that the Jones polynomial of a picture that looks like this, so it has a pair of crossings that could be cancelled against each other, namely this could be straightened out, I need to show that the Jones polynomial of this is equal to the Jones polynomial of the thing in which I've straightened it. Well, let's compute. So what contribution will a piece like this give to the Jones polynomial? Well, a piece like this has four smoothings. The 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1 smoothings. I might have the order wrong. Okay? The four contributions corresponding to them are, well, I hope I wrote the coefficients right, but it's hopefully what I wrote here. Okay? But the nice thing to observe is that one of the contributions has a circle in it. A circle at the end of the computation will count as q plus q inverse. So I can replace this circle by q plus q inverse, and I can simplify the other smoothing. You see, this is actually the same as that topologically. This is the same as that, and this with the circle removed is that. And the finally, this is that. And then I can open parentheses. The q inverse times the zero smoothing here cancels the q inverse times the zero smoothing here. The q here cancels this. And I'm only left with a one smoothing. The one smoothing is the thing written over here. And the thing written over here is the j of the other side. The J of the other side has no crossings in it, so it just stays as it is. And I've proven Rydermeister 2, and clearly with the same amount of effort I could have or with more effort but the same principles, I could have proven Rydermeister 3. Okay? Okay, so we're done with the Jones polynomial. And the next thing is to categorify it. So now, the key thing to be categorified is Q plus Q inverse. Q plus Q inverse is where all the complexity came from. If I look at the picture of the computation, all the complexity came from taking powers of Q plus Q inverse, and then the rest was just shifting these powers by various amounts and adding, which will correspond to the red sums. So the complexity comes from Q plus Q inverse, so I introduce a vector space whose Q the I, meaning I following Hovanov. Okay? So I introduce a vector space V whose Q dimension is Q plus Q inverse. This just means that V should be the direct sum of two subspaces. Each is one dimensional and one of them is in degree 1 and the other is in degree minus 1. So namely, V should be the span of two vectors, V plus and V minus, such that the degree of V plus minus is plus or minus 1. You okay? Okay. And then if I wanted to categorify this box without yet cancelling debts, so only stating what the cows and the certificates and the counter certificates are. So what I'll do is I'll take the box written here and I'll take the polynomial written here and replace it by a corresponding vector space construction. So this is Q plus Q inverse squared. I'll replace it by V tensor V 12 itself twice. Well, I shift the degree by 3 at the polynomial level, so I'll also shift the degree by 3 at the vector space level. Likewise, here I will have V tensor squared shifted 5 times, and here I will have V tensor cubed shifted 6 times. Okay? Now I want a vector space whose dimension will be the column sum of the things I see on the vertices. So I just take the direct sum. So if I want, so the vector space corresponding to column number 1 will be the direct sum of the 3 vector spaces appearing along column number 1. Okay? So, sorry. So I got the spaces part of the complex. Now I need to construct the differentials. So I need to construct maps between the 0 vector space and the 1 vector space and the 2 vector space and the 3 vector space. Okay? Well, depends what I want to do with these maps. Depends what I want to assert. Well, if all I want to assert is that the graded Euler characteristic of the complex I just got is the Jones polynomial, well, I'm done. The graded Euler characteristic, namely the alternating sum of dimensions, is the Jones polynomial by design. Okay? So if I only wanted to assert the statement written here, well, I hereby assert it and I'm done. It just doesn't matter what the differentials are. Okay, I could take the differentials to be 0. Okay? But I want to assert something more. I want to assert that the homology of this complex is in itself a linked invariant. This will be false with 0 differentials. So I have to think a bit harder about how to put differentials into the picture. But fortunately, the picture was drawn in a way that suggests how to put the differentials. Namely, I don't only have the vertices, I also have arrows between them, the edges. So the idea would be to put on each arrow a linear map between the corresponding vector spaces, and then to get the differential, so to get the linear map going from this direct sum to that direct sum, I will simply take the sum of all the corresponding linear maps. Okay? So, you know, to get the part of the differential going from this summand into that summand, I will take this map, and so on. So the idea is to put maps on the arrows, on the edges. Now, I need a condition. The condition is that the differential squared should be zero. This amounts to saying that if I go from one column to a column to up from it, I should be getting zero. This amounts to saying that every time I go around the square, so if I go from here to here in the two possible ways, so in the two ways going around one face of the cube, the two ways must add up to zero. So in other words, around each face, I should have an anti-commutativity condition. So going from here to here, either this way or that way, should add up to zero. Now, anti-commuting diagrams go counter to our intuition. We're sort of used to commutative diagrams. Okay? And fortunately, there is a very easy way to convert cubes from being totally commuting to totally anti-commuting. Namely, there is a certain way to place signs on the edges so that every face will have an odd number of signs along it. And if you do that, then the thing you need to construct is a commutative diagram rather than an anti-commuting diagram. So the way I marked it is the edges with negative sign have a little circle at the beginning. I don't know why I chose that. But so, you know, if you look at this face, then it has one little circle on it. So if I add this sign, it's enough to make this face commuting. Likewise for all other faces. Now, what are these signs per edges? So, here is a combinatorial definition, and here is a more satisfactory definition. The vertices of the three-dimensional cube correspond to the generator of the exterior algebra on three elements. Let's call them dx, dy, and dz. So this is, I'm now talking about sort of ordinary differential forms in R3. So, and furthermore, the edges of the cube correspond, sorry, I think the correspondence is clear. I hope it is clear. Anyway, the edges of that cube correspond to wedging operations. So to go from 1 to dx, you wedge with dx. To go from dx to dy, you wedge with dy. Okay? But these wedging operations sometimes take you from a basis element to, or from a basis element as here, to the negative of the basis element you wanted. So to go from dz to dy wedge dz, you wedge with dz on the right, but you wanted to get to dy wedge dz, not to dz wedge dy, so you get a minus sign. Okay? And so some of the edges here are labeled with minus signs. And if you think a little bit about the definition of exterior products, you find that the well-known fact that dxi wedge dxj is equal to the negative of dxj wedge dxi corresponds to the fact that around every face in our cube, there is an odd number of minus signs. That going this way or going that way differ by a sign. The reason I bothered with this picture is because... Oh, you know what? Sorry. I've got my ordering wrong.
Okay. So let me continue. So now I want to turn my cube into a commutative cube of maps. So let's look on each edge. Now, on each edge of the original cube, where is the original cube? Okay, on each edge of the original cube, only one smoothing changed from, I suppose, going from here to here. The smoothing over here changed from a zero smoothing to a one smoothing. So the picture is more or less the same, except one smoothing changed. Or from here to here, the smoothing here changed from a zero smoothing to a one smoothing. Now, when you change a smoothing from a zero smoothing to a one smoothing, the only cycles that are affected are the cycles that touch this smoothing. So here, this smoothing is touching, well, only one cycle, and it is affected, and the way it is affected is by being split into two. And the third cycle stays in place. Going from here to here, by switching this smoothing, sorry, I want a place where two cycles join. So, going from here to here, by changing this smoothing, the two cycles written over here become a single one. And these are the only things that may happen. So, the way I will define the edge maps is by saying that, well, remember that I have tensor factors of V, one for each connected component. So the connected components that are not touched, will be acted on by the identity. So the V factor that corresponds to this cycle will be acted on by the identity when I apply this map. And then the only thing I need to tell you is I need to give you two maps. I need to give you a map which takes a copy of V to two copies of V, and a map that takes two copies of V to one copy of V. So I need to give you a map called M, which will correspond to a resmoothing that merges two cycles into one, and it's a map from V tensor V into V. And I need to give you a map delta which corresponds to splitting a cycle into two, and it's a map from V to V tensor V. Okay. Now, these maps have to satisfy several conditions. Let me just list them. Okay? First of all, I want the differential over at the end to be of degree zero, because the statement about the Euler characteristic of the homology is equal to the Euler characteristic of the chains depends on the fact that these are really sort of a direct sum of complexes, one in each degree. So I want the differential to be of degree zero overall. But please remember that there were degree shifts overall. So this was degree shifted by 4, this was degree shifted by 5. So when you take account of the degree shifts, I want these two maps, M and delta, to be of degree minus 1. So I want them to lower degree by 1. That's first condition. Then comes the more interesting condition. The more interesting condition is that when you go around a face, well, all faces of the original cube should be commutative. Okay? Because after I play the sine tree, they should be anti-commuting so that this squared would be zero. So all faces of the original cube should be commuting. And let us see what this amounts to. So Well, let's look at the situation where I have three smoothings. So, two smoothings. So if I have two smoothings, one here and one here, and I re-smooth, then I will be getting a picture like this. And if I re-smooth this one, can you see the dot? You know what, maybe I'll make it a wider dot. Can you see the, no difference. Anyway, if I re-smooth here, I will get the left cycle will be untouched, and the one on the right will become a pair. And now, if I over here re-smooth on the right, I hope you can see the dot, I will get one long big cycle. And likewise, if I re-smooth here on the left, I will get one big cycle. So this corresponds to a copy of V, a copy of V, a copy of V. This is a V, this is a V, this is a V, this is a V, this is a V. So this becomes a diagram which takes V tensor V tensor V into V tensor V down to V tensor V to the right to V. And the condition is that this should be a commutative diagram. But what are the maps? Well, the map on the top line is 1 tensor the map M. The map on the left column is M tensor 1. The map on the right column is M, the map on the bottom is M. And the overall condition is that if you do 1 tensor M and then follow it by M, or, you know, in horrible notation, it's M tensor 1, M circle 1 tensor M, then you get the same as M tensor 1 followed by M, or in horrible notation, M circle M tensor 1. That's too messy. M circle M tensor 1. Are you okay? So, the first condition that I get is that the map M, well, it can be, since it's a map from V tensor V into V, it can be interpreted as a product. And the condition that I get is that the product is associative. I should have said that the M better be commutative as well. Because you see, the cycles are not given with any order. I mean, when I made the bijection between the cycles over here and the tensor powers of V down below, I didn't know. There was no a priori way to order the factors. So if this was to make sense, M better be also commutative. So M should be commutative. And then by looking at other potential faces, so this is one potential face in which on both edges you merge. But there are also faces in which on both faces you split up a cycle. Okay, on going in both directions. So looking at these faces, you get a condition which corresponds to co-associative, co-commutative, co-product. And finally, you get a certain condition looking at faces, from looking at faces that look like this. So in one direction you split, and in the other direction you merge. So by looking at faces like this, you get, what have I done? Sorry. In one direction you split, in the other direction you merge, sorry. Wait, no. If you split, you get this. If you Mer, if you ask me to get this, how are we going?
Too many circles.
What?
Too many circles. Two circles.
Too many circles?
There is no problem.
Sorry, now I'm... Oh, yes, sorry. Now on the other side here, I split, so I get... Yeah, no, this is perfectly fine. This is the result of splitting here, and this is the result of merging here. Sorry. So this is a certain condition. So over here I have over here I have a delta tensor 1. Over here I have, on the top right, I have an M. On the bottom left I have a 1 tensor M. On the right I have a delta. And it's a certain condition of compatibility. So M and delta are compatible as above. Okay? You would be tempted to think that this is the condition defining a Hopf algebra, but in fact it isn't. It's the condition it's slightly different, and it's the defining condition of a Frobenius algebra, whatever that might be. But you know, if you wanted to know what it is, well, here it is on the screen. This is the definition. Okay. Anyway, or this is the key point in the definition. So back to our picture. I need to find these two maps, M and delta, and they need to satisfy all of these constraints. You look at the possibility. You basically, at the end, these maps N and deltas are just maps on two-dimensional vector spaces and their tensor powers, second tensor powers. So there isn't that much possibility. So, for example, M should be defined on a basis of V tensor V, meaning it should be defined on V plus tensor V minus, on V plus tensor V plus, on V minus tensor V plus, V minus tensor V minus. It should be of the grid minus 1. So it should be mapping V minus tensor V minus, which is of the grid negative 2, to something of the grid negative 3. But there is nothing in the target space in the grid negative 3, so it must go to 0. It should be mapping V plus tensor V plus, so V plus tensor V plus is of degree 2. It should be going to something of degree 1. There is only one thing in degree 1, and it's V plus. Maybe it should be some multiple of that, so you should be able to put here some coefficient. Okay? It should be mapping V plus tensor V minus. This is of degree 0, so it must be mapping to something of degree negative 1. Here is the only thing in degree negative 1. There could have been a coefficient here. Likewise, by commutativity, this should go to V minus as well, and the coefficient here should be the coefficient here. Likewise, for delta, I wrote the only possibilities, except there could have been coefficients here. You check the compatibility conditions, you check the co-associativity, associativity, and Frobenius conditions, and you find that essentially the only solution after some changes of variable is to make all the coefficients 1, and I'm done. This is the definition of the differentials. Are you okay? Are you with me? Okay. So the complex is now completely defined. So now the Hovanov complex, which is the proposed categorification of the Kaufman bracket or the Jones polynomial, is completely defined. And I should say that I did it all on the example of a trefoil, but had I been looking at a knot with 4 crossing, or in fact with n crossing, everything would make sense just as well. So instead of projecting the 3-dimensional cube into columns, I would project the 4-dimensional cube into the column in which the sum of coordinates is 0, or sum of coordinates is 1, or sum of coordinates is 2, or 3, or 4. Everything would completely make sense
just as well. And now I can make a statement. Now I can make statement theorems. So theorem one, the graded Euler characteristic of the Hovanov complex is a Jones polynomial. Well, this was by construction. I've already proven it. There is nothing to show. Theorem two, I will show later. The Hovanov homology of a link is an invariant of the link. But here's the sort of place that makes it more than the Jones polynomial. In fact, by explicit computations, you can show that the Hovanov homology of a link is strictly stronger than the Jones polynomial. So for example, the Jones polynomial of the mirror image of the knot called 5-1 is equal to the Jones polynomial of the knot called 10-1-32, whatever these are. However, their Hovanov homologies are different. I think this is the simplest example, but there are many more, of course. And, well, I still need to prove invariants. Okay? I need to show that when you do a Riedemann-Lester 2 move, the Hovanov homology before the move, of the thing you get before the move, is the Hovanov homology of the thing you get after the move. Well, I'll stop early. I'll do it next in my next hour. But I'll say one word about how this is done. Okay? You see, I cheated. I somewhat lied when I talked about the Jones polynomial, when I did this proof for the Jones polynomial. When I did this proof for the Jones polynomial, well, the Jones polynomial was defined for knots, okay? But what is written here is not a knot, it's a so-called tangle. It's a small piece of a knot, drawn, well, I didn't bother to draw the circle, but drawn in a small circle, within a small circle in the plane, okay? And I lied and I pretended that the Jones polynomial is defined for tangles, for pieces of knots. In fact, it isn't. Okay? Because, I mean, well, or if it is, it's valued not in Lorentz polynomial, but rather it's valued in pictures in the plane, so-called smoothings, with coefficients that are Lorentz polynomial. Right, this has not been evaluated to a Lorentz polynomial yet, and in fact I don't know yet how to evaluate it to a Lorentz polynomial. I will only know how to evaluate to a Lorentz polynomial once I complete this picture to a knot, and then I will know if this closes up like this, and then it's a single cycle, or like that, and then it's two cycles. Okay? So, well, I cheated, but I cheated in a way that you didn't notice because it was minor, because it was sort of fair cheating. Because indeed, this still is the same as that. So no matter how you close this to a knot, you get the same thing as if you close this into a knot. And likewise here, and likewise everywhere else, and no matter how you close stuff to a link or a knot, you'll have an extra cycle here, which will be worth a Q plus Q inverse. So everything I said made sense, except I perhaps didn't quite use the right words. When you do the same for Hovanov homology, you have to be a little more careful. I mean, you can be a little more careful, and it's been, of course, it's been done. But the point is that sort of you have, well, in Hovanov homology, not only you will have a term for this and a term from that, you will also have a map between these terms. And not only you will have, and likewise you will have a map from this term to that term, and a map from this term to that term, and what these maps are, will only be determined once you complete this tangle to a knot. The maps, as maps between vector spaces, will only be determined once you complete this to a knot and re-smooth all other parts of that knot. And smooth all other parts of that knot in all possible ways. So, we need to have a meaningful notion of Hovanov homology for parts of knots. And that meaningful notion should have a room in it for maps that are not yet fully specified, or vector spaces that are not yet fully specified, and maps between them which are not yet fully specified. That room is the picture now on the board, and I will start my next talk by explaining it and explaining why it is what I think it is. Okay? So I'll stop here and I'll continue tomorrow.
The first chance is not the last chance to ask other questions. Yeah. But
sorry? So the question was whether Hovanov homology is a complete invariant, whether it separates knots. The answer is no. There are examples of pairs of knots with the same Hovanov homology.
But it does distinguish them.
But it does this, but you see, this came after my time, so I don't know it. I'm sure other people will say it. Did I go too quick, too slow? Again, I'm sure I went too slow for Ben, but did I wait? So, you know, if you want my next talk to be better, you have to give me feedback on this one before it. So, thank you.